If you want some encouragement at a difficult time, look at Daniel. Not the prophecies here, but the man, his life, his example, his faith. What I want to talk about in this lecture is Daniel as an individual, a man of conviction. If you look at the book of Daniel, we can open there and start going through it and look at his life. Daniel means God is my judge, or God is judge. It's more likely the former, God is my judge. And what we see is that he was born during the reign of Josiah, and he was of nobility in Judah, so one of the better educated and more affluent people. In the third year of the reign of Jehoiakim, king of Judah, Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, came to Jerusalem and besieged it. Now, Jehoiakim's reign began in 609 B.C., so the invasion was 606 B.C. in the third year. He came to Jerusalem and besieged it. And the Lord gave Jehoiakim, king of Judah, into his hand, with some of the articles of the house of God, which he carried into the land of Shinar to the house of his God. And he brought the articles into the treasure house of his God. Then the king instructed Ashpenaz, the master of his eunuchs, to bring some of the children of Israel, and some of the king's descendants, and some of the nobles, young men in whom there was no blemish, but good-looking, gifted in all wisdom, possessing knowledge, and quick to understand, who had ability to serve in the king's palace, and whom they might teach the language and literature of the Chaldeans. So we see a lot in these first few verses here in the book of Daniel, that Daniel was of noble birth. And the practice of the Babylonians was this. The Babylonians would conquer a territory, and they would take the nobles, the better educated, the leaders, if you like, of the society. They would take them back to their own country, to Babylon, to become Babylonians. That was the idea. They would make them become Babylonians. And they would then distribute the land which those nobles had owned. They would distribute the land to the poor, which would ensure the loyalty of the conquered people, because they would actually be given more land there. You see the reasoning here. Very clever, actually. Some countries, every country is different. And, some countries in the past, when they've invaded another country, have just wiped everybody out. Well, what good does that do? You know, it leaves the land empty, and they're not going to make any gain from it. Some, like the Muslims, for example, force everybody to convert. Different ways, different approaches. But the Babylonians would take the leaders and try to turn them into Babylonians. And then they would give the land to the poor, ensuring their loyalty, at least for a while. Now let's get the background here. 2 Kings is a good place to turn to here, because we need to get the background here. We're looking at the latter part of the 7th century, towards the end of the 600, which means the low 600s, 609, 606, and so on. 2 Kings chapter 22, verses 1 and 2. Josiah was 8 years old when he became king, and he reigned 31 years in Jerusalem. His mother's name was Jedidah, the daughter of Adiah of Boscath. So this was before these events took place. We're getting the historical background here, looking at the decades that led right down to the captivity. And he did what was right in the sight of the Lord. So Josiah then was a righteous king. He did what was right in the sight of the Lord, and walked in all the ways of his father David. Now David was not his literal father. I hope we understand this terminology. David was one of his ancestors. Going right back, David was the first king of this royal line. And he did what was right in the eyes of God and walked in the ways of his father David. Not that David was perfect, as we know, but David's heart was in the right place. He did not turn aside to the right hand or to the left. That means he didn't deviate from God's word. He wasn't going to be persuaded to compromise one way or the other. Now let's look at chapter 23 and let's see a little bit of what Josiah did here. Now there are lessons for us here. We need to understand this. There are lessons for us in our society today, partly because we are descended from ancient Israel as the nation of Manasseh, but also, just generally speaking, these principles apply to all human beings. There are blessings for obedience, and there are consequences for disobedience. And that's a central theme, as you see in Deuteronomy 28, for example, the blessings and cursings chapter. So let's have a look at Josiah. Then the king sent them to gather all the elders of Judah and Jerusalem to him. This is chapter 23. And the king went up to the house of the Lord with all the men of Judah, and with him all the inhabitants of Jerusalem, the priests and the prophets and all the people, both small and great. And he read in their hearing all the words of the book of the covenant which had been found in the house of the Lord. Then the king stood by a pillar and made a covenant before the Lord, to follow the Lord and to keep his commandments and his testimonies and his statutes with all his heart and all his soul, to perform the words of this covenant that were written in this book. And all the people took their stand for the covenant. You see, when you have good leadership, people respond to it. And that's a good example here of good leadership. A man who was turning to God, and others turned to God as a result of him doing that. The king commanded Hilkiah, the high priest, the priest of the second order, and the doorkeepers to bring out of the temple of the Lord all the articles that were made for Baal, for Asherah, and for all the host of heaven. And he burned them outside Jerusalem in the fields of Kidron, and carried their ashes to Bethel. Can you imagine this being done? Let's say our next president, doing this. It's just inconceivable, unthinkable that such a thing would happen. But, here Josiah was determined to clean things up. Then he removed the idolatrous priests, whom the kings of Judah had ordained to burn incense on the high places in the cities of Judah, and in the places all around Jerusalem, and those who burned incense to Baal, to the sun, to the moon, to the constellations, and to all the host of heaven. And he brought out the wooden image from the house of the Lord to the brook Kidron outside Jerusalem, burned it at the brook Kidron, and ground it to ashes, and threw its ashes on the graves of the common people. Then he tore down the ritual booths of the perverted persons that were in the house of the Lord, where the women wove hangings for the wooden image. And he brought all the priests from the cities of Judah, and defiled the high places where the priests had burned incense, from Geba to Beersheba, and so on. And it says in verse 9, nevertheless, the priests of the high places did not come up to the altar of the Lord in Jerusalem. So it goes down and shows you these things that were being done as we try to clean up everything. But due to time constraints, let's move on to what happened after he died. Okay, in verse 28. Now the rest of the acts of Josiah and all that he did, are they not written in the book of the Chronicles of the Kings of Judah? In his days, Pharaoh Necho, king of Egypt, went to the aid of the king of Assyria, to the river Euphrates, and King Josiah went against him. And Pharaoh Necho killed him at Megiddo when he confronted him. Then his servants moved his body in a chariot from Megiddo, brought him to Jerusalem, and buried him in his own tomb. And the people of the land took Jehoahaz, the son of Josiah, anointed him, and made him king in his father's place. Jehoahaz was 23 years old when he became king, and he reigned 3 months in Jerusalem. His mother's name was Hamutal, the daughter of Jeremiah of Libna, and he did evil in the sight of the Lord. You see how it can change from one generation to another. He did evil in the sight of the Lord, according to all that his fathers had done. Now Pharaoh Necho put him in prison at Riblah in the land of Hamath, that he might not reign in Jerusalem. And he imposed on the land a tribute of 100 talents of silver and a talent of gold. Then Pharaoh Necho made Eliakim, the son of Josiah, king in place of his father Josiah, and changed his name to Jehoiakim. So here's another king. And it says in verse 35, So Jehoiakim gave the silver and gold to Pharaoh, but he taxed the land to give money according to the commandment of Pharaoh. In verse 36, he was 25 years old when he became king. He reigned 11 years in Jerusalem, and in verse 37, he did evil in the sight of the Lord, according to all that his fathers, in the plural, in other words, his ancestors, had done, not Josiah, because Josiah was a good king. But here you had two evil kings. And as soon as the king becomes bad, what happens? The people just naturally follow along. Now, you still got maybe some righteous people there. But, you look at this country too. I mean, we've had, without naming names, we've had, one or two presidents that have been very immoral. One in fairly recent years, without naming names. And, it's had a very big effect on the country and the way that people conduct themselves and the attitudes towards morality. And you can see that. Now, of course, a king has greater power. A king in the ancient world had greater power. Not like today. I mean, Queen Elizabeth, for example, doesn't have power like this. But, a king has greater power. And, you know, so therefore people would naturally follow the leadership there, and the consequences, of course, would be devastating. So we come to chapter 24. In his days, Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, came up, and Jehoiakim became his vassal for 3 years. Then he turned and rebelled against him, and the Lord sent against him raiding bands of Chaldeans, bands of Syrians, bands of Moabites, and bands of the people of Ammon. He sent them against Judah to destroy it. You see how they all just wanted just to take parts of Judah, according to the word of the Lord, which he had spoken by his servants, the prophets. In verse 13, he carried out from there, this is the captivity of Jerusalem, he carried out from there all the treasures of the house of the Lord, the treasures of the king's house. In verse 14, he carried into captivity all Jerusalem, all the captains and all the mighty men of valor. And verse 15, he carried Jehoiakim captive to Babylon. So the king's mother, the king's wives, his officers, and so on. So here was the fall of Judah. So that's the historical background. Josiah, a good king, then a return to bad kings, and there have been so many bad kings in the history of the nation. So much evil had been committed. And, you know, finally, the consequences of evil, of rejecting God, are that they were taken into captivity. And, you know, you think about some of the prophecies relating to that, even in the commandments, the fifth commandment, honor your father and your mother, that your days may be long in the land that the Lord your God has given to you. You know, when people reject the laws of God, which should be taught to them by their parents, you know, then one of the consequences can be that they lose everything, and we can lose, you know, a whole nation as a result of rejecting God. Anyway, we'll look at that again later on. But let's go back to Daniel chapter 1 now. Okay, Daniel chapter 1. You've got the historical background. So here's Daniel. Daniel was not an evil man. In fact, there is nothing negative said about Daniel in the scriptures. And that cannot be said of most people. You know, most people's faults, sins even, are recorded for us to see. But Daniel, there's nothing negative said about him. So let's look at those verses again. In the third year of the reign of Jehoiakim, king of Judah, Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, came to Jerusalem and besieged it. And the Lord gave Jehoiakim, king of Judah, into his hand, with some of the articles of the house of God, which he carried into the land of Shinar, to the house of his God. And he brought the articles into the treasure house of his God, his pagan God. Then the king instructed Ashpenaz, the master of his eunuchs, to bring some of the children of Israel, and some of the king's descendants, and some of the nobles. So here's the master of the eunuchs, and you know these men or these boys were to be made eunuchs, which you know is to us a terrible thing. But you know, part of the plan there is to ensure their total commitment. Because, you know, when somebody has gone through the process of becoming a eunuch, when they're castrated, you know, then they've got no divided loyalty, so to speak. They're not going to be out, you know, out late at night trying to find some girlfriend and trying to get married. You know, they're completely in the service of the king, of the throne, so to speak. But at the same time, they would be given special privileges because, you know, they could be given very senior positions there. Then the king instructed Ashpenaz, the master of the eunuchs, to bring some of the children of Israel, and some of the king's descendants, and some of the nobles, young men in whom there was no blemish, but good-looking, gifted in all wisdom, possessing knowledge and quick to understand, who had ability to serve in the king's palace, and whom they might teach the language and literature of the Chaldeans. So they turned them into Babylonians, into Chaldeans. And the king appointed for them a daily provision of the king's delicacies and of the wine which he drank, and 3 years of training for them, so that at the end of that time they might serve before the king. Now, from among them, those of the sons of Judah were Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. To them the chief of the eunuchs gave names. He gave Daniel the name Belteshazzar, which means Bel protects his life. Bel being, you know, their chief God, their chief deity. To Hananiah he gave the name of Shadrach, to Mishael Meshach, and to Azariah Abednego. Now why would they change their names? Well, the reason was because, you know, part of the plan was to turn them into Babylonians, and that included even absorbing the Babylonian pagan religion. And probably most of the young men who were taken as captives to Babylon did change religion, because that's the way it's been For example, you could look at the Ottoman Empire, which was the empire of the Turks, that lasted until about 1920, 21, around there. And that was the way they did things. When they conquered countries, they would take young men who would then become soldiers in their military, and those then could rise up to preeminence, even as high as becoming a sultan of the Ottoman Empire, the leader of the Ottoman Empire. So they were not discriminated against, but one thing they had to do was they had to have the name changed to an Islamic name, and they had to change religion. And then they were given all kinds of privileges. But they were, in effect, slaves. Privileged slaves. Not slaves as in, you know, with chains tied to them or anything, but, they were in the service of the sultan, in totally 100% committed to the sultan of the Ottoman Empire. And that carried on right up until fairly recent times. And that's the way the Babylonians were doing things too. So they had to change religion. But Daniel purposed in his heart that he would not defile himself with the portion of the king's delicacies, nor with the wine which he drank. Therefore he requested of the chief of the eunuchs that he might not defile himself. Now, why would Daniel be upset about eating these foods and drinking this wine? Well, I think we can understand the king's delicacies no doubt included unclean foods. And Daniel knew that these foods should not be eaten. So he and his friends said they would not eat them because it was against their religious beliefs. They were not about to change those beliefs simply because of what the Babylonians said. Sometimes the passage here in which Daniel refused the drink has been used by some people, not within United Church of God, but people in mainstream Christianity, to say that, this is proof that alcohol is a sin. But it doesn't say that. And we know from other scriptures that the consumption of alcohol is all right. Jesus Christ's first miracle was turning water into wine. So, what was the problem here? Well, the custom here was a custom which our friend here from Burkina Faso will no doubt be familiar with. Pouring of libation. Do they do that in Burkina Faso, the pouring of libation? Oh, you don't do that. Okay, well, they do that in Ghana. So let me explain what it is. This is where you pour what is considered a holy water into the ground to summon up the presence of the ancestors, of in effect the pagan gods and the ancestors as well. And this is very much a part of West African culture. Now, I said pouring water. Actually, it's sometimes they do pour water, but there's also alcohol, which has been set apart for this special purpose. So the consumption of alcohol and the pouring of this alcohol into the ground are all a part of this pouring of libation. And from this passage, and when you look into the Chaldeans, you can see that this was a part of their custom as well. That the wine, the consumption of the alcohol, was a part of their religious ritual. So this is what Daniel was had a problem with. It wasn't the alcohol itself that was a problem. The problem was what it was being used for. The Chaldeans would have these big feasts, these big banquets, and these delicacies, the unclean foods would be brought out, and the alcohol would be used as part of the religious devotions, as a part of this particular ritual. So, just as in the same way in West Africa, it would be inappropriate for somebody who believes as we do to imbibe of alcohol which had been pledged to the pagan gods. It would pose a great problem, morally speaking, and the conscience would be troubled. So it was with Daniel. Now God had brought Daniel into the favor and goodwill of the chief of the eunuchs. And the chief of the eunuchs said to Daniel, "I fear my lord the king, who has appointed your food and drink. For why should he see your faces looking worse than the young men who are your age? Then you would endanger my head before the king." So Daniel said to the steward whom the chief of the eunuchs had set over Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, "Please test your servants for 10 days and let them give us vegetables to eat and water to drink. Then let our countenances be examined before you and the countenances of the young men who eat the portion of the king's delicacies. And as you see fit, so deal with your servants." So he consented with them in this matter, and tested them 10 days. And at the end of 10 days, their countenance appeared better and fatter in flesh than all the young men who ate the portion of the king's delicacies. So you see here just how Daniel was a man of conviction. And even though he had been taken captive into Babylon, in this strange land, and, you know, there was a fear, obviously, a great fear of what the Babylonians, the Chaldeans, could do to him and his friends. I mean, naturally, if you're taken as a slave into another country, you're bound to be, you know, frightened. And yet Daniel had absolute conviction, had absolute faith in God, and knew that God would deliver him, you know, from these trials. And so, you know, he just made it clear to the chief of the eunuchs that he was not going to eat these delicacies, and he was not going to drink this wine, nor were his friends. And they just asked for 10 days, and they got their 10 days, and everything was fine. So he's a great example of faith. Thus the steward took away their portion of delicacies and the wine that they were to drink and gave them vegetables. As for these four young men, God gave them knowledge and skill in all literature and wisdom. Going back to verse 4, it says that when they were taken to Babylon, young men in whom there was no blemish but good-looking, gifted in all wisdom, possessing knowledge and quick to understand, who had ability to serve in the king's palace, and of course the language Aramaic would have been taught. And in verse 17 it says, as for these four young men, God gave them knowledge and skill in all literature and wisdom. So, you know, God blessed them to be able to learn these things quickly, because, you know, that would ensure that their privileged position would continue. And they were also going to be used to great power and effect in the kingdom of Babylon. Now at the end of the days, when the king had said that they should be brought in, the chief of the eunuchs brought them in before Nebuchadnezzar. Then the king interviewed them, and among them all, none was found like Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. Therefore they served before the king. So God certainly blessed them for their faith. I overlooked one passage in verse 17. As for these four young men, God gave them knowledge and skill in all literature and wisdom, and Daniel had understanding in all visions and dreams. You see, God blessed them for their faith, and especially Daniel, and gave Daniel understanding when it came to the visions and the dreams. And of course, later on, his reputation was great in this particular area. In verse 19, the king interviewed them. Among all, none was found like these four. Therefore they served before the king. And in all matters of wisdom and understanding about which the king examined them, he found them 10 times better than all the magicians and astrologers who were in all his realm. Thus Daniel continued until the first year of King Cyrus. So Daniel remained in government service, shall we put it that way, right through the 7 decades of the captivity of Judah in Babylon. And it's interesting that, even the king could see that there was something special about these people. And, you know, they were given these privileged positions as a result of that. So, you know, it was apparent to unbelievers, in other words, that there was something special about these men. You know, as people should see in us too, something special because of our relationship with God. There are lessons here. First of all, God blessed them for their faith. Secondly, those impressed with these young men were much older. This is a rare thing. It shows that the boys must have had greater wisdom than normal for their age. Daniel's wisdom earned him much respect. He became a counselor to 2 Babylonian kings and 2 Medo-Persian kings. You know, there aren't many people who, you know, could claim that. Winston Churchill could. He served under 6 monarchs. But that's very unusual. But here, Daniel served under 2 Babylonian kings and 2 Medo-Persian kings, the most powerful leaders in the world at that time. And, he was in favor with them throughout that period. Thirdly, another lesson you can learn is that God can use you anywhere. Just because your circumstances may not be what you would have chosen for yourself doesn't mean that God can't use you. And I think that's a great lesson we need to learn. Like the Apostle Paul said, to be content in whatsoever state we're in, even if it's the state of Ohio. Don't think that's what he was talking about. Anyway, the fourth thing. Although young when deported, probably without parents, because they're not mentioned, Daniel remained loyal to his faith. And that's another thing that's interesting and very important for us to realize, because, there comes a point when this is no longer our parents' religion, it's our religion. And that happens with everybody brought up in the church, brought up with an understanding of God's truth. Daniel remained loyal to his faith even when his family was not around. His parents must have done a good job. Ezekiel, a contemporary, mentions him three times as an example of righteousness. In fact, have a look at the book of Ezekiel for a moment and just see this. Like I said, nothing negative is said about Daniel. Ezekiel chapter 14. Verses 12 through 14, the word of the Lord came again to me, saying, Son of man, when a land sins against me by persistent unfaithfulness, I will stretch out my hand against it. I will cut off its supply of bread, send famine on it, and cut off men and beasts from it. Though these three men, Noah, Daniel, and Job, were in it, they would deliver only themselves by their righteousness, said the Lord God. So Daniel is described there as a righteous individual. And then verses 19 through 20, or if I send a pestilence into that land and pour out my fury on it in blood and cut off from it man and beast, even though Noah, Daniel, and Job were in it, as I live, says the Lord God, they would deliver neither son nor daughter. They would deliver only themselves by their righteousness. Again, Daniel described as a righteous individual. And then chapter 28 as well. Chapter 28, another compliment paid to Daniel here in verse 3 of chapter 28. Behold, you are wiser than Daniel. There is no secret that can be hidden from you. Daniel had a reputation, in other words, for wisdom. Hence this expression, you are wiser than Daniel. So Daniel was looked upon as a righteous and a wise individual. Now let's have a look at chapter 2 of Daniel, because here we see that Daniel was a praying man. Now, when it comes to the meaning of this vision in chapter 2, we will be covering that tomorrow. If you want to prepare for tomorrow, read chapters 2 and 7, and also Revelation chapters 13 and 17, because we'll be referring to them. If you have time, just look at those four chapters tonight before we meet tomorrow morning. I don't suggest you read them tomorrow morning, because I don't think most people are morning people anymore. Revelation 13 and 17. And Daniel 2 and 7. We'll be looking at those tomorrow. So we're not looking here at the significance of the vision. We're not looking here at the prophetic meaning. We're looking at Daniel as an individual, as a man of conviction. And what I want to show here by looking at this passage is that Daniel was a praying man. He prayed a great deal. He stayed close to God, and that's important for us to learn from Daniel's life. So in Daniel chapter 2 and verse 1, in the second year of Nebuchadnezzar's reign, Nebuchadnezzar had dreams, and his spirit was so troubled that his sleep left him. Then the king gave the command to call the magicians, the astrologers, the sorcerers, and the Chaldeans to tell the king his dreams. So they came and stood before the king, and the king said to them, I've had a dream, and my spirit is anxious to know the dream. Then the Chaldeans spoke to the king in Aramaic, O king, live forever. Tell your servants the dream, and we will give the interpretation. But the king answered and said to the Chaldeans, My decision is firm. If you do not make known the dream to me and its interpretation, you shall be cut in pieces, and your houses shall be made an ash heap. I mean, talk about being unreasonable. Now, we'll look at this in that context on Wednesday. So we're going to have quite a bit of time in this chapter. So get to know Nebuchadnezzar, at least learn how to spell his name, please. Okay? But the king answered and said to the Chaldeans, My decision is firm. So here he is throwing a kind of a temper tantrum and threatening everybody and saying, If you can't tell me what my dream means, then I'm going to kill you all. However, if you tell the dream and its interpretation, you shall receive from me gifts, rewards, and great honor. Therefore, tell me the dream and its interpretation. They answered again and said, Let the king tell his servants the dream, and we will give its interpretation. The king answered and said, I know for certain that you would gain time, because you see that my decision is firm. If you do not make known the dream to me, there is only one decree for you. For you have agreed to speak lying and corrupt words before me till the time has changed. Therefore tell me the dream, and I shall know that you can give me its interpretation. The Chaldeans answered the king and said, There is not a man on earth who can tell the king's matter. Therefore, no king, lord, or ruler has ever asked such thing of any magician, astrologer, or Chaldean. I mean, it is obviously an unreasonable request. It is a difficult thing that the king requires, and there is no other who can tell it to the king except the gods, whose dwelling is not with flesh. For this reason the king was angry and very furious and gave a command to destroy all the wise men of Babylon. So the decree went out and they began killing the wise men, and they sought Daniel and his companions to kill them. Because they were, you know, they were wise, they were learned men. This is a little bit like, you know, Pol Pot. Now, if you remember Pol Pot, who was the leader of Cambodia in the late 70s and 80s, had everybody with glasses killed. Because anybody wearing spectacles was considered an intellectual. And so therefore they all had to be killed. This is why I had laser surgery recently. just in case we have a Pol Pot take over here in America. I have to use these for reading, but I could always get by without them if I had to, if my life depended on it. Then with counsel and wisdom, Daniel answered Arioch, the captain of the king's guard, who had gone out to kill the wise men of Babylon. He answered and said to Arioch, the king's captain, "Why is the decree from the king so urgent?" Then Arioch made the decision known to Daniel. So Daniel went in and asked the king to give him time that he might tell the king the interpretation. Then Daniel went to his house and made the decision known to Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, his companions, that they might seek mercies from the God of heaven concerning this secret, so that Daniel and his companions might not perish with the rest of the wise men of Babylon. So, you know, Daniel immediately went to his three closest friends, those who believed the same as he did, and all four of them then went and prayed about this and asked the God of mercy, as it says here, asking a merciful God to reveal the secret to them. Then the secret was revealed to Daniel in a night vision, verse 19. So Daniel blessed the God of heaven. Daniel answered and said, "Blessed be the name of God forever and ever, for wisdom and might are his. And he changes the times and the seasons. He removes kings and raises up kings." This is a pivotal verse, probably the most important verse in the book of Daniel. It's verse 21. Because it reveals to us the overwhelming, the theme of the book of Daniel, the overruling sovereignty of the one true God who is in charge, who knows what he's doing. And, you know, our security comes from him. He removes kings and raises up kings. He gives wisdom to the wise and knowledge to those who have understanding. So Daniel's very encouraging then as an example of prayer. Also an example of humility, because in verse 20, you know, he doesn't try to claim that he understands this vision. He says this knowledge and understanding has come from God. Blessed be the name of God forever and ever, for wisdom and might are his. So he gives God credit. He's not trying to promote himself or claim that there's something special about himself. He places the credit exactly where it is due. And he gives God the credit for revealing this thing to him. So let's carry on here. God, in verse 22, reveals deep and secret things. He knows what is in the darkness, and light dwells with him. "I thank you and praise you, O God of my father." So he gave God thanks as well. "You've given me wisdom and might, and have now made known to me what we asked of you, for you've made known to us the king's demand." Therefore Daniel went to Arioch, whom the king had appointed to destroy the wise men of Babylon. He went and said thus to him, "Do not destroy the wise men. Take me before the king, and I will tell the king the interpretation." Then Arioch quickly brought Daniel before the king and said thus to him, "I found a man of the captives of Judah who will make known to the king the interpretation." The king answered and said to Daniel, whose name was Belteshazzar, "Are you able to make known to me the dream which I've seen and its interpretation?" Daniel answered in the presence of the king and said, "The secret which the king has demanded, the wise men, the astrologers, the magicians, and the soothsayers cannot declare to the king, but there is a God in heaven who reveals secrets." Now imagine what courage it took to say this. You know, here was the most powerful man in the world, Nebuchadnezzar, who had absolute authority. He had absolute authority. He could do whatever he wanted to do. So he could have had Daniel killed on the spot. But Daniel stood up for his God, for his belief, and said, "There is a God in heaven who reveals secrets. And he has made known to King Nebuchadnezzar what will be in the latter days. Your dream and the visions of your head upon your bed were these." And then he goes on and explains it. In verse 30 he says, "But as for me, this secret has not been revealed to me because I have more wisdom than anyone living." You'd think he'd want to just promote himself to save his own life, because this decree had gone out to have all the wise men killed. But he says, look, it's not me that has come to understand this vision. It says, the secret has not been revealed to me because I have more wisdom than all these other wise men in your kingdom. But for our sakes, who make known the interpretation to the king, and then you may know the thoughts of your heart. Now, there was a purpose. God revealed these things so that, you know, all of these people could be saved. But also God was working with Daniel. God was working even with Nebuchadnezzar and with Babylon and with the successive kingdoms to fulfill his plan. And so Daniel then goes on and explains all this. Let's go now to chapter 4. Again, we're just looking at Daniel as a man here, as a fine example of devotion to the true God. In chapter 4, here's this unreasonable Nebuchadnezzar again. Verse 4 of chapter 4. I, Nebuchadnezzar, was at rest in my house and flourishing in my palace. I saw a dream which made me afraid. This is Nebuchadnezzar's second dream now. I saw a dream which made me afraid, and the thoughts on my bed and the visions of my head troubled me. Therefore I issued a decree to bring in all the wise men of Babylon before me, that they might make known to me the interpretation of the dream. Then the magicians, the astrologers, the Chaldeans, and the soothsayers came in, and I told them the dream, but they did not make known to me its interpretation. But at last Daniel came before me. His name is Belteshazzar, according to the name of my God. In him is the spirit of the holy God. Let's just pause for a moment there and understand Nebuchadnezzar's mindset here, okay? In many societies, there are many gods. Polytheism, you know, lots of different gods. I remember visiting a couple of Hindu ladies once, young ladies. They were in their late 20s, two sisters. And, they were living in England at the time. They had come from India. And in the Indian culture, you know, their father would not let them go out of the house. They couldn't go and mix with young men. And, you know, they were desperate to get married before they reached 30. And so they had been reading our magazine, and they wanted to join the church so that they could find a husband. They were quite open about this. They wanted to join the church so they could find a husband. And so we got to talking about religion and what they believed. And they said they believed as we do. They believe in God the Father. They believe in Jesus Christ. But as it turned out, they also believed in the other 500 gods that they had grown up with in their Hindu religion. See, so when you've got 500 and you find out about God the Father, you find out about Jesus Christ, you just add them to the 500, you see. So you see the way that Nebuchadnezzar's mindset would work. Belteshazzar was his God. Daniel had a different God. So it doesn't mean there's only one God, you see. So we need to understand that, because we'll come up against that again as we go through Daniel. And I told the dream before him, saying, Belteshazzar, chief of the magicians, because I know that the spirit of the holy God is in you. You know, Nebuchadnezzar could see that there was something special about Daniel, even in terms of his relationship with his God. And no secret troubles you. Explain to me the visions of my dream that I have seen and its interpretation. Now let's go down to verse 18. This dream I, King Nebuchadnezzar, have seen. Now you, Belteshazzar, declare its interpretation. Since all the wise men of my kingdom are not able to make known to me the interpretation, but you are able, for the spirit of the holy God is in you. Then Daniel, whose name was Belteshazzar, was astonished for a time, and his thoughts troubled him. So the king spoke and said, Belteshazzar, do not let the dream or its interpretation trouble you. Belteshazzar answered and said, my lord, may the dream concern those who hate you, and its interpretation concern your enemies. Again, great courage here on the part of Daniel. Because this dream that he was about to explain went against Nebuchadnezzar. It was in favor of his enemies. So he was the bearer of bad news to this absolute monarch who had absolute power and could do with Daniel whatever he wanted to do. And, the others, the astrologers, the magicians and so on, they wouldn't want to have to carry this message to Nebuchadnezzar, because they'd be afraid of getting their heads cut off. And not just their heads, but their wives and their children and everybody else would be killed, because that's the way that it works in most societies. Even today it works that way in lots of different countries. But, Daniel was afraid, but he was also courageous. He hesitated there, but he was a courageous man. Now let's look at chapter 5. Here's Belshazzar, who was the last king of Babylon. Belshazzar the king made a great feast for 1,000 of his lords, and drank wine in the presence of the 1,000. While he tasted the wine, Belshazzar gave the command to bring the gold and silver vessels, which his father Nebuchadnezzar had taken from the temple, which had been in Jerusalem, that the king and his lords, his wives and his concubines, might drink from them. Then they brought the gold vessels that had been taken from the temple of the house of God. And the king and his lords, his wives and his concubines, drank from them. They drank wine and praised the gods of gold and silver, bronze and iron, wood and stone. You see, here's that example again of the wine, the banquet, and the wine being used as a part of their religious ceremony. So that takes us back to, you know, why Daniel would not drink that wine at the beginning of the book. In the same hour, the fingers of a man's hand appeared and wrote opposite the lampstand on the plaster of the wall of the king's palace, and the king saw the part of the hand that wrote. Then the king's countenance changed, and his thoughts troubled him, so that the joints of his hips were loosened, and his knees knocked against each other. The king cried aloud to bring in the astrologers, the Chaldeans and the soothsayers. You'd think they would have learned by now that these astrologers and soothsayers, etc., and never get anything right, like the horoscope in your newspaper, which I hope you don't read. But, you know, these things are just ridiculous. The king spoke, saying to the wise men of Babylon, "Whoever reads this writing and tells me its interpretation shall be clothed with purple, which is a symbol of royalty, the color of royalty, and have a chain of gold around his neck, and he shall be the third ruler in the kingdom." Now all the king's wise men came, but they could not read the writing or make known to the king its interpretation. Then King Belshazzar was greatly troubled. His countenance was changed, and his lords were astonished. The queen, because of the words of the king and his lords, came to the banquet hall, and the queen spoke, saying, "O king, live forever. Do not let your thoughts trouble you, nor let your countenance change. There is a man in your kingdom in whom is the spirit of the holy God." So his reputation was still there, even a long time later. Now, this is Belshazzar now, the next king. "And in the days of your father, light and understanding and wisdom, like the wisdom of the gods, were found in him. And King Nebuchadnezzar, your father the king, made him chief of the magicians, astrologers, Chaldeans, and soothsayers. Inasmuch as an excellent spirit, knowledge, understanding," this is his reputation, "inasmuch as an excellent spirit, knowledge, understanding, interpreting dreams, solving riddles, and explaining enigmas were found in this Daniel, whom the king named Belteshazzar. Now let Daniel be called, and he will give the interpretation." Then in verse 13, Daniel was brought in before the king, and the king spoke and said to Daniel, "Are you that Daniel who is one of the captives from Judah, whom my father the king brought from Judah? I have heard of you that the Spirit of God is in you, and that light and understanding and excellent wisdom are found in you. Now the wise men, the astrologers, have been brought in before me that they should read this writing and make known to me its interpretation, but they could not give the interpretation of the same. And I've heard of you that you can give interpretations and explain enigmas. Now if you can read the writing and make known to me its interpretation, you shall be clothed with purple and have a chain of gold around your neck, and shall be the third ruler in the kingdom." Then Daniel answered and said before the king, "Let your gifts be for yourself, and give your rewards to another." So, you know, Daniel had the opportunity here to, you know, get all this reward. But he said, "No, I don't want it. Yet I will read the writing to the king and make known to him the interpretation. O king, the Most High God gave Nebuchadnezzar your father a kingdom and majesty, glory and honor." He took every opportunity, you see, to mention God. And also even to say that it's God who even allowed you to be here on this throne. O king, the Most High God gave Nebuchadnezzar your father a kingdom and majesty, glory and honor. And because of the majesty that he gave him, all peoples, nations and languages trembled and feared before him. This was a nation that ruled over many nations. Over many peoples, many ethnic groups. Whomever he wished, he executed. Absolute power. That's what it involves. You know, you can execute whoever you want and make all these decisions. Whomever he wished, he kept alive. Whomever he wished, he set up. And whomever he wished, he put down. He could do whatever he wanted to do. But when his heart was lifted up and his spirit was hardened in pride, he was deposed from his kingly throne and they took his glory from him. Then he was driven from the sons of men. His heart was made like the beasts, and his dwelling was with the wild donkeys. They fed him with grass like oxen, and his body was wet with the dew of heaven, that he knew that the Most High God rules in the kingdom of men and appoints over it whomever he chooses. But you, his son, Belshazzar, have not humbled your heart, although you knew all this. You know, this is the major problem with absolute rule, that, you know, it goes to people's heads. and they become arrogant and they lose their humility. You've lifted yourself up against the Lord of heaven. They have brought the vessels of his house before you, and you and your lords, your wives and your concubines have drunk wine from them. And you praise the gods of silver and gold, bronze and iron, wood and stone, which do not see or hear or know. And the God who holds your breath in his hand and owns all your ways, you have not glorified. What courage he had to be able to stand up and say all this before a man who had the power to have him put to death, just as Nebuchadnezzar had the power to put him to death. Then the fingers of the hand were sent from him, and this writing was written, and this is the inscription that was written. And then he goes on to explain all this, but you know, we'll come back to that another time. And then in verse 29, Belshazzar gave the command, and they clothed Daniel with purple and put a chain of gold around his neck and made a proclamation concerning him that he should be the third ruler in the kingdom. That very night, Belshazzar, king of the Chaldeans, was slain, and Darius the Mede received the kingdom, being about 62 years old. So this now brings us to chapter 6. And here's the final chapter we'll look at here regarding Daniel. It pleased Darius to set over the kingdom 120 satraps to be over the whole kingdom, and over these three governors of whom Daniel was one, that the satraps might give account to them, so that the king would suffer no loss. Then this Daniel distinguished himself above the governors and satraps, because an excellent spirit was in him, and the king gave thought to setting him over the whole realm. So the governors and satraps sought to find some charge against Daniel concerning the kingdom, but they could find no charge or fault, because he was faithful, nor was there any error or fault found in him. Isn't that amazing? Wouldn't that be great to have that written on your headstone? You know, that there was no error or fault found in him. This was the reputation that Daniel had. Then these men said, "We shall not find any charge against this Daniel unless we find it against him concerning the law of his God." Daniel wouldn't compromise with God's law. So they knew the only way they could possibly get rid of Daniel was by attacking his religion, attacking his beliefs. So these governors and satraps thronged before the king and said thus to him, "King Darius, live forever. All the governors of the kingdom, the administrators and satraps, the counselors and advisors have consulted together to establish a royal statute and to make a firm decree that whoever petitions any god or man for 30 days except you, O king, shall be cast into the den of lions." So here the king, in other words, was deified. And for 30 days, nobody would be allowed to worship any other god. Now, you know, what would be the reaction of most people? I think even most people who believe as we do would say, "Well, it's only 30 days. I'll just get by. You know, I'll just, you know, I won't do anything to rock the boat here. I'm sure God will understand." But what did Daniel do? Well, we'll have a look. "Now, O king, establish the decree and sign the writing so that it cannot be changed, according to the law of the Medes and Persians, which does not alter." Once the law was passed, then it could not be changed. "Therefore, King Darius signed the written decree. Now, when Daniel knew that the writing was signed, he went home. And in his upper room, with his windows open toward Jerusalem, he knelt down on his knees three times that day and prayed and gave thanks before his God, as was his custom since early days." Now, notice that. There's a great deal in that verse. When Daniel heard about this decree, the first thing he did was go back to his house and he prayed. You know, he went to God about this problem. Now, what he was doing was illegal in terms of the decree. But you know, when there is a conflict between God, between God's law and man's law, then we have to follow God. We ought to obey God rather than man, we're told in the book of Acts. So what he did was he went and prayed. And it says he knelt down on his knees three times that day and prayed and gave thanks before his God, as was his custom since early days. So his custom had been, you know, his habit had been since childhood to pray three times a day. Now, you'd think he would have closed the door so nobody could see, because what he was doing in terms of the decree was illegal. But it says he opened his windows toward Jerusalem so he could be seen. You know, Daniel was not going to be intimidated by this law, which was beyond all reason, by this decree which had come out. And he was not going to, you know, grovel. He was not going to hide. He was not going to just pretend that he didn't follow God for 30 days just to get by until this decree was over. It's kind of interesting, too, that those men who wanted to get rid of him went to the king and just got the king to issue this decree for 30 days. I think they knew that Daniel could not go 30 days without revealing himself as a true follower of the true God. But he wasn't going to compromise, not even for 30 days. So these men assembled and they found Daniel praying and making supplication before his God. He was on his knees before his God. And they went before the king and they spoke concerning the king's decree. Have you not signed a decree that every man who petitions any god or man within 30 days, except you, O king, shall be cast into the den of lions? The king answered and said, the thing is true, according to the law of the Medes and Persians, which does not alter. So they answered and said before the king, that Daniel, who is one of the captives from Judah, does not show due regard for you, O king, or for the decree that you've signed, but makes his petition three times a day. And the king, when he heard these words, was greatly displeased with himself. The king realized he'd been trapped. And he set his heart on Daniel to deliver him. And Daniel was undoubtedly his best man, his most loyal subject. And he realized these men had set a trap for him to get rid of Daniel. And he labored till the going down of the sun to deliver him. He tried to figure out a way out of this. But the problem was the Lord of the Medes and Persians could not be changed. Then these men approached the king and said to the king, know, O king, that it's the Lord of the Medes and Persians, that no decree or statute which the king establishes may be changed. So the king gave the command, and they brought Daniel and cast him into the den of lions. So the king spoke, saying to Daniel, your God, whom you serve continually, he will deliver you. Even the king knew, you know, Daniel would be delivered. Then a stone was brought and laid on the mouth of the den, and the king sealed it with his own signet ring and with the signets of his lords, that the purpose concerning Daniel might not be changed. Now the king went to his palace and spent the night fasting, and no musicians were brought before him. Also his sleep went from him. Then the king arose very early in the morning and went in haste to the den of lions. And when he came to the den, he cried out with a lamenting voice to Daniel. The king spoke, saying to Daniel, Daniel, servant of the living God, has your God, whom you serve continually, been able to deliver you from the lions? And Daniel responded, O king, live forever. God save the king. My God sent his angel and shut the lions' mouths so that they have not hurt me, because I was found innocent before him. And also, O king, I've done no wrong before you. Then the king was exceedingly glad for him and commanded that they should take Daniel up out of the den. So Daniel was taken up out of the den, and no injury whatever was found on him, because he believed in his God. So again, that example of Daniel as a man of great faith. Just finally, a couple of verses in Daniel chapter 9. We're not going to read the whole chapter here, but Daniel chapter 9, this is a chapter that gives us the 70 weeks prophecy, which we should be covering on Thursday. And it's interesting here that when the angel Gabriel came to Daniel, he says this in verse 23, at the beginning of your supplications, the command went out, and I've come to tell you, for you are greatly beloved. So here is Daniel being told by the angel Gabriel, and obviously the words are from God, that you are greatly beloved. And chapter 10 as well, in verse 11, he said to me, O Daniel, man greatly beloved. And then in verse 19, O man greatly beloved, fear not. So Daniel was greatly beloved by God. No negative things said about him. You know, Daniel was a fine example for us, and you know, we should look to him as such, and realize as well that when we're in trouble, when we have temptations, or we have pressures, or we suffer persecution, that Daniel should be an inspiration for each and every one of us. Nothing negative said about Daniel. Now, you know, you could be cynical and say, well, you know, he was a slave. So he didn't have the freedom to do whatever he wanted to do. He was a eunuch, so he couldn't get into the area of temptation that many men succumb to. But, you know, the fact is he lived in extremely difficult circumstances, and yet he remained loyal and faithful to God. Even when his life was on the line, he didn't compromise. He did not compromise at all. There's no record of him compromising. There is with David, you know, King David, but there wasn't with Daniel. And Daniel was a fine man of conviction who always stood up for what he knew to be right and would not compromise with God's law. Our time is almost up. Any questions relating to what we've covered? Yes. What's your name?
Richard. Back in 16, where you were talking about Josiah being one of the kings over Israel, is that you use maps to determine a time frame when Daniel was taken into captivity in the Babylon? Is that what I understand tonight?
No, not really. He was king of Judah, too. But what I was looking at was just the background leading up to Judah being taken into captivity. That you had a king who was righteous and tried to clean up the whole country. But as soon as he died, his two sons in succession were both evil, and you know, both rejected his way. And you know, this led up to the fall of Judah, the fall of Jerusalem. So I wasn't trying to use it to set any date or anything, but you could look up the dates of Josiah's reign. Yes, Aaron.
What do you think it was about Daniel that comes in such a great faith in God and just had that power and belief in
him? Well, probably a lot of factors. I mentioned that his parents must have done a very good job in teaching him as a child, because he was taken as a young man, undoubtedly without his parents. I mean, usually when people are taken into slavery, you know, the slave owners don't take into account your family loyalties, and they don't take the whole family together. So he was undoubtedly taken without them. So they'd done a very good job in teaching him. Perhaps there were other things in his background as well. But I think another thing is, you know, sometimes you just need to think things through. In the position that he was in, either he could go along with everything that they wanted, or you know, he could put his trust in God. And in the circumstances, you know, I think the sensible thing to do is to put your trust in God. But having said that, most people didn't. You know, most of the others didn't. And I'm sure the others changed their names and went along with the pagan God and everything else, you see. So, you know, Daniel still had a great deal of conviction. Yeah.
Belteshazzar?
Yeah. No,
Bel
was the name of the god. The whole word.
It says like, you know, the name Daniel got the name Belteshazzar, and then it says named after my heart god. And you know why they would have given Daniel the name after their god?
Well, again, let's use an analogy here with other countries. I mean, in Ghana, for example, children are named for a specific purpose. I mean, we might, in our culture, name a child after a grandfather or a father or a mother or whatever. But usually we don't think about what the name itself means, okay? But in most cultures they do, and they think about what the name means. And so the name was given, Bel protects his life. You know, it was just a name. I don't think it had any special significance. One of the others could have been named, you know, the same name. But the point is, you know, let Bel look after you. That's basically what the name means. But he was named after their god, Bel, and that's part of his name.
Bel or Baal?
Yeah. Well, there's a connection, I'm sure, but, you know, Bel was the name. I mean, again, every place would use a different name. Because Daniel wrote the book.
So he talked about
himself in the
name.
Right. It was very common, even until recent times, for somebody writing a book about themselves to put themselves in the third person rather than say I or me. I mean, there are even examples in English literature of that. So, you know, it has been done. So he was just writing about them, and that's recorded and been passed down.